Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Zingari. The archives. It sounds like someplace with stone caverns and secret files hidden away behind padlocked gates. Well, it's not exactly that, but the State Archives, How to Love, has a lot of interesting stuff in them, and there's the Records Department, too, chock full of interesting information from the state's past. Holding the key to all of that is State Archivist and Chief Records Officer Tanya Marshall. She joins us to give us a peek into what's contained there and the work those offices do, and she'll share some information on legislative openings and inaugurations in Vermont's past. Tanya Marshall, thanks for being with us this morning.
Good morning, and thank you very much for having me.
It's our pleasure. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Tanya Marshall a question, you can give us a call at 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Tanya, without taking up the whole half hour here, what does your department do?
Sure. So I am the director of the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration. We're actually a division of the Secretary of State's office. And we were created in 2008 by the legislature, which consolidated two existing divisions. One was already underneath the Secretary of State's office, and the other was underneath Buildings and General Services. And we oversee the statewide records and information management program. So part of our duties there are working collaboratively with local and state public agencies in all three branches of state government on better record keeping for public records, setting the retention requirements, and also setting the preservation requirements. And that gets into our duties as state archives, in that we take legal custody of permanent records and we provide access to them, and we're also responsible for preserving them for their entirety.
Wow.
So that's kind of the overarching role of what we do for state government and also for local government.
So how far back do the archives go? I don't mean lengthwise, but I mean, you say you preserve them for their entirety. So how far back can we trace the archives that you have there?
Yeah, so the records, some of the oldest records that we have in the state archives are from the 1760s, so they predate statehood. 1791 was when Vermont entered the Union. So we have different court records. You know, Vermont's an interesting state in that, you know, both New York and New Hampshire had put land claims. So that's why you'll see some of the earlier parts of United States government dovetailed within Vermont. So our oldest records are actually from 1760. And then we have the Republic, you know, when we're independent, for those 14 years. And then we'll have the 1791, all the way through present time. So we do have records that are 2020, in the state archives, and some are 2021 already.
Oh, yeah. Right. That's right.
Archives.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for reminding me. We're in a whole new year. I got to remember that next time I write out a check.
We don't often get records this quickly, but we did have, one of the state officers was sworn in yesterday, which meant that a state officer, Lieutenant Governor's office, has done a transfer already of some records that we're working on today.
So Molly Gray holds the record for the first records of 2021. Congratulations, Lieutenant Governor Gray. So was my description of the archives and the records department anywhere close to the truth? The stone caverns and the big gates that you hold the key to?
Yeah, so we're actually located in Middlesex in a complex behind the state barracks. We operate two facilities here. One is the State Record Center, and if you can picture, two stories high, a football field deep of state records, all three branches of government. It's pretty modern. We have forklifts that go up and down to retrieve the boxes. It's for analog and paper records, and these would be records that are still owned and in the legal custody of their creating entities. And we provide this as a service. It's just more cost effective to run the state record center that way. And then attached to the state record center is also our state archives vaults, and those were added in 2010. Again, more modern facilities, so you're not going to see us in the basement anymore, though that is historically where some of our archives have been.
Right. So
you were telling the truth that part.
Thank you.
But yeah, it's been a long time coming in terms of being one in a consolidated facility like this one, and to have the first archival vaults, you know, really built above ground and having the capacity to do the work that we need to do. In addition, we also have a digital archives, so that's a system versus a physical repository that you'll see for the analog and the paper records that we preserve for state.
And when you say vaults, you know, we kind of, again, have that image of like a big bank vault. Is that word vault more symbolic, or is it an actual vault that you would protect things in?
Yeah, well, historically, a vault was a cabinet that was fireproof, and you will still see them in parts of, you know, different smaller town clerk's offices might still have some of those, and that is, you know, historically what it is. Right now, it follows more underneath fire protection standards, so a true vault actually meets certain criteria, and ours, therefore, you walk in, it will have, you know, a fireproof door and a couple different layers, and we have two different kinds of vaults that we have in the facility, plus we have one that doesn't quite qualify underneath the fire protection standards as a vault, but it does qualify as a record center that's protected for fire, and that is just larger scale. So, you know, we're not going to be, you know, we do have a dial
okay.
You know, with a code for some of ours, but they're, you know, for based on 2010, we've done a lot of renovations. So we've had new vaults added, and yeah, they're large facilities.
Tanya, what brought you into this world of archives?
That's a good question. My background, my bachelor's degree is actually in art history, and you know, I spent a lot of time as a undergrad more looking at the social context for that. So I focused in two areas. One was medieval art, and that's really based on having a population that was largely illiterate and understanding how art was used to communicate information to the public. And I also focused a lot on public building architecture. But then I went to graduate school and got exposed to library and information science and archives, records, and information management. And I went to University of Maryland and really just grasped onto this concept of public information. And I have been doing this for over 20 years and absolutely love it.
It sounds like it. You've got this energy and this verve about archives. What kind of requests do you get for information or records there?
Everything. There's never a dull day, which is probably another reason why I like that. You know, putting on the different hats that we have, we can get a lot of requests just related to the management of records. What are the legal record keeping requirements? Our staff do a lot of work, and especially our appraisal. How do we determine that something is permanent? Is a lot of legal research and understanding what was the intent of the legislature when they've asked, you know, an agency to report on a particular matter, or that they should collect information on a particular subject, and also the records that are produced, permitting, and so forth. So we'll get a lot of requests that are sometimes based on records that we don't yet have in the archives or would not necessarily be appraised as archival, and helping facilitate that particular research on that. And then in terms of the archives itself, and we have a reference room that is open to the public. We did reopen in June, so it's open by appointment. In the past, you didn't need an appointment, but right now, just due to COVID. And the kind of questions that we get really varied. We have individuals who are doing, you know, research on subjects that are of interest to them. And, you know, we have court records, we have legislative records, and we have executive branch records in the state archives. They're all focused on state government. That's how that's particular set up right now, and local government records will be with the town clerk or the other officials responsible at the local level. So we'll have people come in and do, you know, whether they're academic research or legal research. This time of the year, it gets very busy with state employees actually doing legal research. So the legislative branch, they'll be looking at records in the past related to legislative action to understand intent. We have a lot of genealogists and people doing family history. It's really a wide range of questions that we receive on a regular basis.
I love that. I love that people are, you know, using this this and learning there at the archives and the records. I called on you for information about the opening of the state legislature and whether we've had any that have been held remotely before, like we had two this year. So what do we know about that?
Yeah, so obviously we're modern times. The remote option is available, but may not have been available in the past. The current state house is the third state house, and that opened in 1859. There had been a fire in 1857. So just between, it was just 1857 and 1858, that the legislature was displaced. So 2021 is really the first time that we're seeing the legislature not assemble within the state house due to COVID restrictions and doing a lot of their work remotely. And the last time that happened, they were still in Montpelier. So this is a unique aspect to it because obviously legislators are not all physically living in Montpelier right now. So this would be the first time, actually since 1805, which is when it was put into statute that Montpelier was going to be and was to be the location for the General Assembly.
What about inaugurations that have not been held at the State House in front of both chambers of the legislature?
Yeah, so this would be the first time. Yesterday was on the front steps of the State House. This would be also the first time since 1859. The Hall of Representatives was specifically built to include joint assembly, which would include the Senate in the back and also the Supreme Court representatives. And that has been held traditionally there since 1859. When the legislature was displaced between 1857 and 1858, it's my understanding that they met at the Old Brick Church, which is how it's been described. It doesn't exist anymore. I had to do a little bit of research to figure out exactly where it was. And that was where the representatives were meeting for the 2 years that the State House was being rebuilt. And I should add that the State House prior to that had burned in January of 1857. And at that point, the legislative sessions were actually in October. It didn't change until 1915 through a constitutional change that the General Assembly opens in January. And the Senate met at the courthouse. So joint assembly, I have to imagine, probably was held at the Old Brick Church, and that is where the governor gave inaugural addresses for those two years, but this would be the first to not have that that presence within the State House, and also all the legislators convening together in joint assembly to listen to the gubernatorial address.
So even during the Spanish flu pandemic, just over 100 years ago, they were able to meet jointly and have the inauguration there.
Yes, yes. So that would have been, when you're thinking about the earlier part, so this would have been in the time frame where it would have been January. So January 1918 was not, wasn't quite the height of it yet. And then by January 1919, there was a new governor who came in, Governor Clement, and he gave his address in the State House and actually held a large ball afterwards. So at that point, there wasn't a lot of restrictions in terms of public gatherings and social gatherings within the state.
Tanya, because I know you do this, what part of your job do you really geek out about?
There's probably a couple, depends on the day, I guess, for that. Parts that I really like is, one of our roles within the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration is to document state government and to really understand the context to why decisions were made and make sure that this information is available for others. So there's some aspects of that I really enjoy are, actually related to legislative acts and understanding, sometimes a sentence or two has a whole story behind why the legislature chose to put that language in a particular statute. The legislative records are also a great way to understand how we were structured. We track agencies and departments over time, which you can imagine gets a little convoluted, particularly in the executive branch as reorganizations occur and functions move from one entity to another. So I enjoy kind of uncovering that because sometimes there isn't a lot of information that's already been discovered, and we can learn a lot from the past. You kind of have to know where you were to understand where you're going. And we do get a lot of requests from legislators. So I, you know, personally enjoy helping them as they kind of sort through that as they're looking at new bills. And the other part is just helping people. Most people who get into the profession really like to make sure that information is available and readily accessible, and helping people find it is really the core to our mission.
Do you get to undertake research projects of your own and dig into the archives?
On occasion, I'll do it based on a request. We have a lot that we do here at the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration. So in addition to the public records piece that we do, we also authenticate documents for foreign use. We also certify vital records. We also have a legislative clerk function. So we monitor the bills as they come in and out. So research isn't always something I have the opportunity to do, but if I get a request for it related to, oftentimes it is related to the legislation, I will do that. Or if there's a particular area of interest as we're watching, continuing issues is something that was started by my predecessor, Gregory Sanford, and that is about that context. So when we have time and we can see an issue emerging in the legislature, it's kind of going back and seeing how the issue came up in the past and how did the state make decisions and why, and then providing that information to those who have to make decisions in current times.
When I say the word archives, I'm not even sure what I'm talking about here, Tanya. So help me out. It's a rare interviewer who admits these things, but I'm happy to. But what are actually in the archives?
What are in the archives? Yeah, it's a good question.
Thank you.
By
you're too kind.
They're records that have continuing value beyond just what they're initially intended to do. So when we look at records that we're appraising to come into the archives, we're really looking at government functions. One, persistent rights, for example. So it could be persistent rights related to an individual. It could be persistent rights related to an entity. And those are types of records that come into the state archives. Other records that might have more legal, you know, when you think about legislative acts and being able to have that in the archives. And then others are based on informational value that really inform us about our past, our policies, and our decisions. So when we say in the state archives for the state of Vermont, that actually means that the Secretary of State's office and the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration takes legal custody of those records, and it doesn't matter what format they're in. They can be paper, they can be analog tapes, for example, or they can be digital. And when we take legal custody, we become the owner and responsible party for those records, not only from the preservation standpoint, but from the public records request standpoint as well. So it's a big distinction. Obviously, we wouldn't want to take, and we don't, records that are too early. So if you think about court cases that are still ongoing or might reopen, those would not, they could be on their track to come to the archives, but they're not quite ready to be fully legally transferred into the archives. So when we talk about archives, we're talking about records that have been created by other parts of state government and both all three branches that have met the criteria of continuing value to the state underneath different criteria that we have established, that the Secretary of State really takes legal custody of and responsibility for forever. And so, you know, when I describe it to a lot of people, I say, you know, it's expected 200, 400, 500 years from now that what we have in the archives will continue to be accessible to future generations.
We have Ann calling from Orange, and I think she's going to have probably a much more intelligent question than I've asked. Ann, go right ahead. What's your question for Tanya Marshall?
My question is security. And I'll be brief, and she may also be brief, because I don't expect any secrets to come out.
That's right.
But in view of current times, I would hope that there is plenty of security. And I'm also addressing the issue of security for the Internet. For the
digital records.
Yes.
Yep.
And I would hope that would be very, very severe, because this is a good place for people that do not care to make themselves heard. And so
Yeah, and to do a lot of damage. And those are great questions. And Tanya, and Anne is correct. I know you can't give us intimate details, but you know, should we feel safe that you have the security in place for these archives and these digital records?
Yes. So one of our, you know, underneath the statewide records and information management program that we oversee, it includes the framework that covers a variety of different information management controls, which is inclusive whether it's archives or just records that are not yet there. And so protection is actually a key one. And protection goes everything from, you know, whether it's building security or if it's related to internet security, how Anne had raised that, and also just, you know, inadvertent, you know, kind of situations where someone may inadvertently, accidentally, say, delete or alter or modify a record, just, you know, even a state employee by accident, if you think about that. That's all built into our statewide records and information management program. So not only does that apply when we work with all the public agencies that we're providing support to help elevate their programs to having really strong management controls, but it also applies to the state archives and the records that we take personal responsibility for as part of our functions of doing the archival work.
How much of the state's records are now digital?
So right now, I would say almost all records are created digitally. It's very rare to have a record that's created paper, because you would think about someone writing them out. So majority of records are created digitally. Governor Shumlin was probably the best example of seeing how the shift in state government has happened. When a governor leaves office, the governor's records are transferred to the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration. And so Governor Shumlin transferred a very small number of paper records, very few boxes, and yet a terabyte of digital records. Whereas Governor Douglas, on the other hand, very small number of digital records and a larger volume. So that shift has happened. And, you know, in the past, there were time frames where people felt more comfortable printing from electronic, but we really encourage, especially from the archival standpoint, is the importance of having the original record as it is actually used by the agency, and those would be digital. So we work collaboratively with all the different branches, you know, some of the shift that's happening right now in the judiciary to electronic, you know, filing and electronic systems. That's where we're collaborating as well, because those records will be a time frame, a gap between them coming into the state archives and them being used by the judiciary and having to build in that infrastructure because technology changes on a regular basis. So the systems that we use for the digital archives are actually, I want to say it, that they're capturing different formats and time so that we can still read them as humans.
Tanya Marshall is the state archivist, the chief records officer. It's been enlightening speaking with you this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure thing. CBS News is next. Then we come back to celebrate 40 years of the Savoy Theater in Montpelier here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. When I moved to Central Vermont in 2003, one of the things that gave me such delight was having the Savoy Theater in town. Living in Montpelier, I could just saunter into downtown on a weekday evening and catch a wonderful film. Sometimes there'd be this crazy run of films that you just could not stand to miss week after week. Other times you just trusted that the film that they were showing, which you didn't know anything about, would interest you, and it usually did. Moving to Chittenden County, I've sadly lost that connection to the Savoy, but it's still there for Vermonters to enjoy, now celebrating its 40th anniversary. One of the people who's been so instrumental in the success of this Montpelier icon is a Montpelier icon himself, Rick Winston, and he joins us now to discuss this wonderful theater. Rick, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hello, Rick. Great to be here.
Listeners, you can call and join the discussion if you've got a question or a great memory of the Savoy. Give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Rick, the Savoy has its roots in a film society, so let's start there. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I moved to Vermont in 1970, basically fresh out of college. Mm-hmm. And the two places that I went to college, both Columbia in New York City and then the University of California at Berkeley, mm-hmm. I had the chance to go to the movies any night of the week. I wanted to see an old classic, a newer foreign film. And it was one thing about moving to Vermont that I really missed going to the movies. Yeah. And got to talk to other people who had been recent arrivals in Vermont, and we all agreed this was a real something we all missed. And the opportunity came in 1972 to start a once-a-week film society. It was in the basement of the Pavilion building in that wonderful 200-seat auditorium. And that was, from the get-go, was quite a hit. And as the years went on, started thinking, well, this could be, there could be a possibility for every night of the week art cinema, showing foreign films, classics, documentaries, whatever. And that opportunity finally came in late 1980. The theater opened the first week of January, 1981.
Wow. So I think it was called the Lightning Ridge Film Society.
Lightning Ridge Film Society, named after the road where I still live.
Oh, wow. So how did you make that jump from a film society to the creation of the Savoy Theater?
Well, there are a number of factors that came into play, and one was the two original partners in the Savoy. One was Gary Ireland, who had run the Goddard Bookstore for quite a few years. Mm. And then there was my brother, John Winston, who had great construction and design skills. My brother John bought that building. Now it's now owned by Tony and Joan Beard. But the space had been Elmsley the Forest, which then moved next door. And finally, there was a space that was available. There was a major fundraising that went on, needless to say.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we did was we kind of pre-sold tickets to raise money, and some people still might have some of those coupons.
Wow, you were well ahead of your time. That was great. Where did the name Savoy Theater come from, Rick?
Well, this was another happy accident. The theater was under construction. We didn't know what to call it. Seemed like it was appropriate to make a real break from Lightning Ridge to create it shouldn't be the Lightning Ridge Theater. That would, do something brand new.
Mm-hmm.
And then we discovered, I don't know exactly what the circumstances were, that on that very spot there had been a movie theater, Nickelodeon style, from 1908 to 1915. And Eric Bardroff, who then ran Country Camera, came over one day with a photo of the original facade of the building, and there it was with a sign out front saying Savoy Theater.
Hmm.
And the name Savoy has a long theatrical history, going back to Gilbert and Sullivan putting on their shows in the Savoy Theater and London.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that the previous owners of the building, it was the Masuko family, a longtime Montpelier family, and old Mr. Masuko said that it was named after originally after the Savoie region of Italy, where his forebears came from. So we didn't have to think too much about that one.
Land it in your lap. Oh, that's great. You know, we just had the state archivist on, and I love that this 40th anniversary has had you digging back through the Savoy Theater and the Lightning Ridge, you know, archives. It's kind of wonderful.
Yeah, nothing like archives.
Yeah. When you were building the theater, Rick, what kind of space limitations were you facing?
Oh, boy, oh, boy. Well, the drawing board was already there. And we shared a interior wall with them, with the staircase going up to the second floor, kind of right in the middle. So if you've been in the Savoy, you know it's a long and narrow space. Yep. And right away, we were limited by space. And there were long discussions about, well, if we make the projection room 2 feet smaller, we could make the concession area 2 feet wider. But no, we need room to move around in the projection booth. And so eventually it was, you know, something like 22 rows of eight seats each with an aisle in the middle. And then there was the question of how high we could go, because we were limited on the ceiling height, especially when we knew we were going to have to put in a heating system and heating and air conditioning. Right. So the screen could only be so high. And that, for years, has proved to be just one of the things we have to live with, that when we show foreign films, it's not unusual for everybody to take their seats, and then the film begins, and one after another, people get up and start to move
right,
so they can see the subtitles better. But, it's a very cozy projection booth and a very cozy concession area.
Yep.
And when we had a hit movie, it was very, very stressful. Of course, we wanted the hit.
Right.
We could live with the stress.
Tell us about the first film you showed in that opening night.
Okay, well, thereby lies is a tale. Our first film was supposed to be the Australian film My Brilliant Career, which had just opened, was getting great notices, and it became clear just a week beforehand that we were just not going to finish in time to actually have people there. And very reluctantly, we had to cancel that booking and move it to later in January. And the number two film that we had lined up was a revival of Casablanca.
Mm.
So Casablanca was our first film, and it kind of became appropriately even more iconic. It was very connected in people's minds with the theater. We wound up having special showings of it on our 5th anniversary, the 10th anniversary, like that.
Mm-hmm. There was a little hiccup, though, when the film arrived. Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah. our first two projectionists, the late Andrew Klein and Norman Bloom, who currently is living in Middlebury, and we said, okay, we're opening Friday night. The movie is arriving on Wednesday, so they say, and we'll just plan to spend all day in the booth, and you guys can get to figure out how to put a film together. We'll take it apart, put it together, take it apart, run it through the projector, get everybody up to speed. So the film arrived, and the 35-millimeter films in, of course, this isn't happening anymore, but they usually arrived in two heavy cans, mm-hmm. three reels. In each can that you had to splice together. And we opened can one, and there was Casablanca, and we opened can two, and there was Lenny starring Dustin Hoffman, not what we had signed up for. So frantic phone calls ensued, and people assuring us, this never happens. Anyway, we got other reels of Casablanca the next day, and off we went.
I would love to see a mashup of the first half of Casablanca into the second half of Lenny sometime, if you ever decide to do that at the Savoy. The Savoy Theater in Montpelier celebrating its 40th anniversary. Rick, what kind of films were you showing in those early days at the Savoy?
The intention was to show a mix of things, some classic movies, some new movies, some documentaries, really keep it very, very diverse. But it became clear very early on that what people, now that it was a seven-night-a-week theater, what people really wanted to see was new movies. So we quickly shifted gears and had any idea about was that the opening of the Savoy coincided with two wonderful events. One was the birth of what was known as the American Indie Movement, because just in those 80 and 81, John Sayles' first film was Return of the Secaucus 7, Spike Lee's first film, She's Gotta Have It, Jim Jarmusch's first film, Stranger Than Paradise, and the Coen Brothers was Blood Simple. So we had, it was really wonderful, and it was clear that that's what audiences wanted to see. And also, we opened right in the middle of what later became known as the Australian New Wave, and films like My Brilliant Career, Picnic at Hanging Rock, Smash Palace from New Zealand. That this was foreign, but not too foreign. They were still speaking a variant of English. beautiful landscapes, great stories. So, and then the occasional documentary, very much geared to niche audiences in central Vermont. One was a documentary about the life of the psychologist Carl Jung. Another was about Tibetan sand mandala paintings that had a line around the block.
Wow.
So we were always open. And then we started to get local filmmakers like Jay Craven. We showed a lot of Jay's movies. And then the occasional classic when there was a restoration and a beautiful print we could show that had some publicity attached to it.
Here's an email we got, and it really puts a fine point on what the Savoy is all about. It's from Kenrick. As a projectionist in recent years, one of the pleasures I've had is getting to talk to moviegoers about what they saw. I think in most commercial theaters, there's little personal touch to the experience. The Savoy offers the chance to really get to know the people that you are serving. Rick, what do you think about that from Kenrick?
Yes. Hi, Kenrick. There's a lot of personal touch and many conversations that happened on the way out of the film. I speak to certain people that are in the higher up in the chain, that is the people that they make the movies, then there's the distributors, and then, way at the bottom, there's the exhibitors, the people who actually get to show the movies. And the more I heard about how the movie industry actually worked, the more I realized we are in the best possible place in this setup, because people actually get to tell you how much they like the movie right there on the spot.
Right.
Usually, when things are going well, most of them do like the movie.
That's right.
I was just talking with somebody who had recommended the movie Wise Blood, directed by John Huston, And I remember that that was a movie we showed in our first year. And one of our regular customers, I ran into him earlier that week. He said, you know, I really didn't like that movie, but I can't stop thinking about it all week. So I guess it must be a good movie. So there's a lot of opportunity for those kind of conversations. Sometimes the people are so enthusiastic that you'd think that the staff were the ones who actually made them.
At some point, yeah, Rick.
That was a, yeah.
At some point along came Downstairs Video. So how long did that last?
Downstairs Video started. You know, the Savoy was there for 5 years before the video boom started, the VHS, and many naysayers in the industry said, this is going to spell the end of theaters because, you know, people can do their own film festivals at home. They don't need you anymore. So we were scared, and it did through the years of 85, 86, 87 were a real dip. But we had friends in Northampton, Massachusetts, who were a few years ahead of us doing the Film Society, a few years ahead of us starting a theater, which is the Pleasant Street Theater, and then a few years ahead of us doing the Video Store. And the advice of my friend John Morrison down there was, start a Video Store, no doubt about it. He said, people will come to the Video Store 5 nights a week, and then on Saturday, they want to see what's the new film that's they got to see.
Rick, let me cut you off. And Dave from Warren, very quickly, because we're almost out of time, go right ahead. What do you got for us?
Hey, Rick Winston, Dave Sellers in Warren calling.
Hey, Dave. Speaking of old regulars.
I wanted to thank you so much for what you did in sustaining films. In the Valley, we would, it's amazing. We'd say, hey, let's go to the Savoy. No one cared what was showing.
Right.
It was a surprise to come in. Anyways, it was always fabulous. And Rick, you were always so wonderful being there. And over the years, you know, we just wanted I'm thanking you for everybody in the Valley who would go over there all the time. Hey, let's go to the Savoy. And the linear long aisleway was wonderful because as you walked back, you could not leave the theater without finding somebody you hadn't seen in a while.
Dave, I'm going to have to cut you off. We're out of time. Yeah. But what a beautiful way to end this discussion, Dave and Rick.
I just want to, before we end, I just, you know, got to thank my ex-partner, Gary Ireland. And my wife, Andrea Sirota, who took over as my co-owner of the Savoy when Gary left for Seattle. So big thanks to Andrea and Gary and for the fantastic staff that we all had over the years.
And Rick Winston, thanks to you. Rick will forever be a part of the Savoy Theater. And don't forget about, he's also the author of Red Scare in the Green Mountains, a wonderful book. Rick, it's a pleasure having you this morning. Thanks.
Okay, and please support the Savoy because they're going through a tough time with the pandemic.
You got it. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We'll be back after the CBS News to chat with Bob Ney and then Chef Emery.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. It's time to get an update on the news that happened this week from national correspondent Bob Ney. Bob, we need you this week more than ever. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
Bob, we usually start with talking about COVID, but I want to jump over that and
right, gotcha.
Yeah, get your take on Wednesday's attack of the Capitol.
Well, you know, for me, it was pretty personal, not just because I served there, but also I was in charge of the Capitol Hill Police, used to be Speaker Hastert, myself as chair of House Administration, and then the Sergeant of Arms, and then, of course, the structure below that. So, you know, I'm intricately knowledgeable about the, you know, internal structure of the Capitol and the police and things of that nature. So when I saw it, naturally, first, I thought, I can't believe they're breaching the Capitol, and then second, I couldn't believe they did what they did inside the Capitol and tried to stop the process of the certification of Biden. I couldn't believe the president said, oh, you know, Trump or Pence is the last hope. I'm with you. Let's go down Pennsylvania Avenue. He knew well that Pence could do nothing. I've been on that floor as a teller for Electoral College. The vice president just runs the ceremonial part of it. He can do nothing. The president knew that. But, you know, a lot of people out there thought, well, this is it. There is our last, you know, hope. And it led to what happened. So I think it's terrible. People died. It's just a blight on this country. And, of course, if you look today at the president's communication, he's pretty alone right now. Most of the Republicans who people, some of my friends are saying they're squishes. And but what did people expect to happen? And those, Rick, that, you know, you and I have talked on your show for how many weeks now about the reality of what couldn't happen.
That's correct. Had you ever experienced anything so fraught on the Hill, in the Capitol, anything where you felt, you know, what I'm sure the senators, the representatives felt as they heard people crashing through into the Capitol?
Well, yes, I was in charge of the Capitol Hill security when 911 happened, and I can recall the Assistant Sergeant of Arms on the phone with me. We actually pulled the evacuation button the second time in the Capitol's history. 1812 was the first time where they evacuated. We pulled the button because we accidentally, it's a long story, but we accidentally knew that the Pentagon was about to be hit. We knew before it got hit through somebody on a bridge that called us and saw the plane coming. So we evacuated the Capitol, and of course 10,000 people were fleeing all over the place to get out of there. And and we were told point blank by the, you know, security, NSA, CIA, that an incoming plane, in, I remember, in 14 minutes would hit the Capitol, which was bound from Pennsylvania and, of course, brought down. So, yes, that. The second was the anthrax, where we had an unknown, you know, potential killer in the Capitol. And the third was ricin. We had to actually evacuate one entire building and clean it out at the cost of $70 million, move everybody over D.C. And, again, Steny Hoyer, he's now the number two ranking member in the Democratic side. He was my ranking member on the committee. And we would do phone calls with the staff, anybody who wanted to join us, because, you know, people go there and they don't expect that they go to work and that they're going to be killed. And so, yes, there was trauma. Three times we've experienced trauma in there. But I must say, if you were there and you heard the crashing of the windows and things, I think for a lot of people that's pretty bad, and I think maybe a lot of people thought they were going to be killed.
Yeah. We had a listener ask yesterday if we have an idea of how much in monetary figures damage has been done to the Capitol in this attack.
No, we don't, but with the there's some of the damage they did is going to involve security enhancements that we did way back in 2001. Steny Hoyer and I did after 9/11 because we were very vulnerable. And so, without going into detail, some of the things they did is not just breaking something; it's, you know, got to be retooled for other reasons. So, I mean, honestly, if you said to me, guess. I mean, I've got to think with cleanup and everything else under the sun, it's got to be $500,000 or $600,000. There's also some missing, you know, laptops. One other thing, Rick, I did want to mention, and there's resignations happening now, which I knew would happen with the Sergeant of Arms and things. But I also wanted to mention that people are saying, well, why did they let them through the barricades? Why didn't they shoot them in the rotunda? You know, there's a lot of reasons. Hundreds of people came into the Capitol without being screened. They could have had automatic weapons under their coats. They could have had bombs. There was a skeleton crew of Capitol Hill police, really, they had to do what they do, and they were told to stand down as much as possible, except when they came up the steps and were about to breach the floor, they were shot at, and that's when the lady died.
And I guess that, you know, that begs the question, why was there a skeleton crew when, you know, we knew that there could be something like this happening in Washington,
right.
D.C.?
Well, now it was, and I said skeleton because it was a full crew, but it was a skeleton crew for the day, if that makes sense to you. For the situation, it was definitely a skeleton crew.
Gotcha, yeah.
The normal full crew was a skeleton crew because of what happened. I don't believe in my heart of hearts that there was any discussions because, look, remember something. The Sergeant of Arms sits under Zoe Lofgren, who's the chair of House Administration, which I used to be, and under Speaker Pelosi, and I was under Hastert, Speaker Hastert. There is no way that discussions were held by the hierarchy of the Capitol Hill Police that, well, we're going to treat these people different because, you know, they're Trump supporters and they're white majority. That just didn't happen.
Yeah.
Here's what I think happened, though. They assumed, because the president was speaking to them and they were down the street, you know, they assumed, okay, you know, they're going to blow off some steam and it's going to be okay because nobody said we're going to riot the Capitol or we're going to go towards the Capitol. It was a bad call, a horrible, horrible error. They should have been prepared. They should have had backup with the intensity of this and the anger that was going on, plus the president of the United States feeding the fact that, you know, the last stance is down the street, Vice President Pence, he can do it. I'm with you. Let's go down Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah. Let's take a quick call from Marcia in Barry. Go right ahead.
Morning, and thank you. I'm wondering, who were the other two people who had died? We know about the invader, the woman, and then the police officer that died this morning, but who were the other two?
Well, I think the other two, I talked to some friends up on the Hill, and I don't know the names, but supposedly somebody had medical emergencies, and this is only what my friends tell me.
I think
you're
right.
It was like a heart attack.
Right. And I think they were part of the protesters, part of the attackers.
Oh, yes, part of the protesters, and it was a heart attack, according to what friends tell me.
Bob, what are you hearing? What's the rest of the world saying, thinking about what they observed on Wednesday?
Well, on a personal note, because I do have a lot of friends around the world who are, you know, not political. I mean, they're just friends, and they are in shock and sad. They're sad at what they see, you know, because they've looked up to the United States so much. And, you know, these types of things of stop the process, take control of the floor, sit in the speaker's office. These happen in, you know, third world countries, banana republics, you know, whatever you want to say. That's where it happens, not normally in the United States. So I think our global image is in really bad shape for a wide variety of reasons. And I'm not sure that a brand new president instantly changes that. There's a lot of reasons that, you know, right now we're not in the trust factor. Now, that doesn't mean, there were some things that Trump did that were, you know, okay to, you know, put America first, I think, but some things were pushed over the line, like with, you know, NATO and some other issues that were out there and some of the policies. So the opinion is twofold. One, we're kind of in tatters about how we function with our allies. And number two, though, the incident that happened here until this morning when the president kind of finally admits, you know, he's going to leave peacefully, I think it caused bad feelings for those two different aspects.
There's been talk by Democrats of second impeachment proceedings. What's your thoughts on that? Is it going to go anywhere?
Good luck on that. I think this is a protection statement, and I'll tell you why, including the 25th Amendment, where Speaker Pelosi said that the cabinet needs to invoke it. I think these are protection statements, and what I mean by that, the speaker knows both processes could not occur in the next 15 days. I don't care how fast you rushed it. It could not occur. So the statement kind of covers them, because now if the president does something really, really outrageous in the next few days, they can say, you see, you know, we warned you to do something. So I think this is more practically pushing the president, putting pressure on him, but also covering themselves so that if he does do something, they warned you know, warned the public about it and the political forces in the cabinet.
Is there any support left among GOP leaders for President Trump?
Well, in all reality, in that over, and this is why I think you saw the demeanor and the tone and everything of the president this morning, you know, and talking about how people should be arrested that, you know, went to the Capitol. I think, in my opinion at least, and I asked some friends about this today in D.C. that are a little closer to the White House, obviously, than I am, but I think that this is now boiled down to the president's children and his son-in-law, and there's crickets otherwise.
Wow.
You know, the vice president's staff, chief of staff's been banned from the White House. The president's very, very alone at this point in time, and even Lindsey Graham, you know, who was turned into the best friend of the president, is on the other side of this. Yeah, so I think he's quite alone, and I think he realizes it.
Bob, I hope next Friday's conversation is quite boring.
I hope so. I hope so, too. I'm with you on that.
Yeah. Bob Ney is a national news correspondent who we have the privilege of speaking with every week. Thanks so much, Bob, for your insights. All right. How are there so many wonderful places to enjoy, to learn from, to have our kids get involved with in this wee place? Sorry, native Vermonters, but with everything you have to offer, Flatlanders can't help themselves from moving here. I know that firsthand. Today, I want to shine a light on the Billings Farm and Museum in Woodstock, and here to tell us about some of the programs they've got lined up is Chef Emery Gray. Chef Emery, what a treat it is to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me, and good morning.
Good morning. Now, give us a description of what the Billings Farm and Museum is.
Amazing, all summed up in one word. Billings Farm and Museum is, we're very unique in that we're sort of a living history museum telling the story of a farm from the 1890s, but we're also a working dairy farm all at the same time. So people can come see the museum, learn about the history of the area, the history of Vermont, learn about sustainable living and sustainable practices, and then be able to see how that translates into the modern day times with having a working farm and gardening and, again, all about sustainable living and community.
What is your role there, Chef?
Not only am I a chef, but my official role is farm-to-table manager. So that means it is very exciting. I'm in charge of selling all of our wonderful cheese that our cows help to produce. They produce all the milk, and then we send our milk to Grafton Village Cheese, who produces three kinds of cheddars for us. So I sell the cheese and am in charge of the dairy operation. In that sense, I'm also in charge of the food educational programming, working closely with our education manager. And I run our dairy bar here on site, which is also very delicious because we sell ice cream and root beer floats and things during the hot summer months. And then transition to a warm cup of hot spice cider, apple cider donuts in the fall. And all the way through right now in our dairy bar, we have hot chocolate. And you can buy a s'mores kit and roast s'mores by the fire outside.
No, knock it off. You're really killing us now. Hey, so Chef Emery, what were you doing before you came to the Billings Farm?
Before I came to Billings Farm, I was one of the pastry chefs at the Woodstock Inn and Resort.
Mm. Wow. Do you have a specialty?
Everyone always asks. There's nothing that I haven't found that I don't like to make, but probably my favorite would be bread. Homemade bread is fantastic, and how incredible it is to have so many just a few simple ingredients in different ratios can make a delicious loaf that you can share with your friends and family.
Now tell us about one of the programs. It's the Billings Backyard Series.
Yeah, Billings Backyard Series are a series of classes that we put together here at Billings Farm for adults, kids, and families alike who want to learn and practice sustainable living skills. So our class coming up on January 23rd is we're all teaching about quick pickling. So the class is hosted by me, Chef Emery, and it's really geared towards, well, how do you save some food that you might not use up before it goes bad in your fridge, or how do we turn the food into something interesting that you can add to a heavy winter dish, or really just spice up some of your favorites. So we'll be working on quick pickling some food items such as red onions, grapes, and ginger, and tried and true favorites as carrots, cauliflower, and beets. So you can add pickled red onions on top of a taco just to give it an extra bite or an extra flair, as if you might find in a restaurant. But it's extremely easy to be able to do it at home and have fun in your kitchen, all while staying safe during COVID.
That's a brilliant idea. Yeah, you have those vegetables that you're not quite getting to. It's like, okay, let's pickle them. When you say quick, how much are we talking about? How much time are we talking about? I don't know. Is it in the preparation you're talking about quick? Is it in the amount of time we have to store it till it's pickled? What's the quick in quick?
Quick pretty much covers everything. Quick pickles, usually they can soak up the brine overnight. It's very easy. You can prepare whatever vegetable or fruit you're pickling, put it in your container of choice, and the quick aspect is in creating the brine. So you have your sugars, your spices, your vinegars. You bring all of that to a boil and really pour it over the vegetable or fruit that you're pickling, and then within an hour to overnight, you have a quick pickled vegetable.
Oh, you're making me so hungry. that is really kind of great. I love that. What are some other of these programs in the Billings Backyard series that people can sign up for?
Right now, we have our next program, which I'm extremely excited about. We're partnering with Master Gardener Ben Pauley. Ben Pauley works as the Master Gardener for the Woodstock Inn, and he also creates our amazing Billings Farm Sunflower House, which you can come and visit on site at the beginning of August and through the end of September. But Ben's next class will be Planning Your Garden, so learning how to sustainably plant and plan a garden for springtime, trying to give it a more holistic approach, and he'll talk about seed starting and what plants you can have in your garden to attract pollinators and other beneficial insects. He's really just an amazing wealth of knowledge and fun to be around. So that's February 27th from 10 to 11:30, and you can sign up for Ben's class on our website at billingsfarm.org.
When we're talking about these Billings Backyard Series programs, are they being done virtually, or does one attend them there at the farm?
Right now, our classes are done virtually just because of COVID, and it's fun and exciting because no matter where you are, you can join. The last Billings Backyard we had, I was very happy because we had a mother and daughter. Mother lives in Burlington, daughter lives in Nashville, Tennessee, and they both joined for the class so that way they could do something together and have a good time and just really appreciate being in the kitchen and learning together, which is really fun and fantastic.
What was that one about?
That was holiday tea and cookies. So I led a class on making a variety of holiday cookies and teas, and then how you can package to be able to ship to your friends and family all over the country since we all can't see each other in person for the holidays.
You mentioned the cheeses that you make there and that there's three kinds of cheddars, so you've got to tell me what they are.
We have our, probably one of the most popular is our Woodstock Reserve cheddar. So it's what our sharpest cheddar, aged a minimum of 15 months, usually about 18 months, and it's a really great cheddar with a bite. You can use it in any recipe. Fantastic paired with cheese and crackers. Our second cheddar is our butter cheddar. Again, probably one of our most popular and most versatile to cook with. So throw it in a mac and cheese or melt it down for a fondue. It has a slightly milder taste than our reserve cheddar and sort of very reminiscent of a Munster or Gouda cheese. And it pretty much literally melts in your mouth. It's that just creamy and delicious. And our third cheddar is our butter cheddar, but it's smoked. So you have that really amazing smoky flavor. You can add a little spice and flair to a dish that way. But three amazing cheddars that you can also find and buy on our website, on our shop. And they're also in the local area with the co-ops. If you're in the Woodstock area, Gillingham's has it. The Woodstock Farmers Market has it. Yeah, they're really, really amazing products and something I'm very proud of, and very proud of our farmers here who work really hard to care for our lovely Jersey herd to make our delicious cheese.
Oh, the Jerseys. I love them. Hey, you just linked together the three most magical words in the English language, smoked, butter, cheddar. I can't even believe that. I'm dying over here. All right. You've got virtual education programs in addition to this one. So tell us about those.
Well, our virtual education programs are geared towards homeschoolers and also teachers who, you know, teach at a regular elementary school, giving their students something, offer their 20-minute live sessions here with our education manager. Kids have the opportunity right now to learn about winter on the farm then and now, so comparing winter back in the 1890s to winter now and how a farm learns and operates. They get an interactive looking for being able to look at artifacts from the 1890s to learn a little bit about the history. Same thing for our homeschoolers. They might not join with a teacher, but they all join remotely via Zoom for a program to learn, again, winter on the farm, winter 130 years ago. And our February program coming up is all about draft animal power, so learning about draft animals, horses and cows and their importance on a farm, both back in the 1890s and today.
Another neat thing you've got going on is the Woodstock Film Festival.
Yeah, our Woodstock Vermont Film Series, another great way to have a little history and culture and get be inspired by the countryside and having watching a film with a strong sense of place. So the Woodstock Vermont Film Series is curated by local Vermont filmmaker Jay Craven, and he's put together a wonderful series of films that are streaming now through the end of April. Film series passes are available on our website at billingsfarm.org. This weekend's film is Moynihan. Mm-hmm. I'm actually watching it this evening, and I'm extremely excited.
So wonderful.
Yeah. Get the popcorn ready.
You know it. Yeah, Danny Patrick Moynihan. Can't wait to see that. Go ahead.
It's fantastic. John Lewis's Good Trouble is playing January 14th through the 17th. And then a film that I'm excited about is called Made You Look. It's the true story about fake art.
Mm. Wow.
So we have, again, many, many amazing films coming up, streaming at two a month now through the end of April.
We're just about out of time, but are people allowed at the Billings Farm Museum right now?
Yes, we are open to the public on the weekends. We will be open MLK weekend, so that's the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And then we're open again for a little bit of a longer period during our maple celebration. So weekends in February, but a special whole week of events from February 13th to the 21st, learning all about maple and maple recipes and how maple is incorporated here on the farm.
I love it. That's Chef Emery Gray of the Billings Farm and Museum in Woodstock. To learn more about the programs there, you can visit billingsfarm.org. Chef Emery, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And then we're going to take a break, and then Speaker of the House Jill Krawinski joins us. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri, and I'm in a little bit of trouble right now. We were to have the new Speaker of the House, Jill Krawinski, on with us, a representative from Burlington, and unfortunately we haven't been able to reach her, so I have no guests, so if you don't call in, listeners, and chat with me, you'll hear me nattering on for the next half hour, which isn't the loveliest thing that you want to hear. Let's do this. We had open phones yesterday and discussed what happened on Wednesday in Washington, D.C. If you didn't get to take part yesterday while we chatted about that, you can call now. Remember, I just ask that you be respectful when you call 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Everyone's opinion is welcomed here, and I'm not in a position to tell you you're right or wrong. I'm simply here to listen to what you have to say. It was a really painful moment for this country, and some of you might want to emote about what happened because of what you're feeling for the events of that day. If you'd also like to call and talk about what is going to happen in the state legislature this biennium, what you would like to see passed, you can call us, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Heck, if you'd like to list something for the Trading Post, I'll even take that at 244-1777, toll-free, 877-291-8255. But if you call in about the Trading Post, I'm going to have to read the Trading Post rules. Our number here, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And let's see, we've got a caller now. So our director, Danny McGivergan, is juggling the phones, doing his best. Let's see who we have. We do have Representative Jill Krawinski. And so, Representative Krawinski?
Hello, how are you, Rick?
Welcome, Speaker of the House. How does it feel to be addressed in that way?
It feels like an incredible honor. It's been quite a week, for sure.
Yeah, tell us about the events of this week compared to what would normally be happening in Montpelier.
Well, because of this unprecedented pandemic, we want to make sure we are putting the health and safety of Vermonters first. And so for the first time ever, we kicked off our legislative session on Zoom. And while it was hard not to all be in the same space together in the building, it still had an incredible feeling of solidarity and working together to help, you know, get Vermonters through this pandemic with a plan that leaves no one behind. And, you know, after we had this just incredible moment together, it was only hours later that we saw, you know, the horrifying events in the U.S. Capitol. And it was so incredibly heartbreaking and created so much anger and outrage. But we just had this stark contrast of our two experiences. And a lot of, you know, we're all still processing these events.
For those of us who haven't been involved in the ins and outs of the legislature, how does your job change when you go from a representative, even a majority leader, which you had been for the last 2 years, to now House Speaker?
Yeah, so my role as Speaker of the House is to preside over the chamber, to assign committee assignments, to work with all caucus leaders, Democrats, Republicans, progressives, on making sure that things are, all the trains are running on time, that bills are being introduced, assigned to committees, and creating a strategy and a game plan of setting priorities and goals for what policies will be taking up in the legislative session.
And how do you go about doing all that virtually now?
Well, you know, Rick, we have experience doing that last year. You know, under the incredible leadership of Speaker Johnson, we were able to make the transition from governing in person to online. And we learned a lot through that process. And so for us, even though we're starting with a new legislature and new committees, we took all the lessons that we learned during those COVID Zoom sessions and use those lessons to help prepare us for this biennium.
What did you learn in the 2 years that, you know, she was House Speaker, you were Majority Leader? What did you learn from that relationship that will help you moving forward in the role as a House Speaker?
Well, I'll say that so much of it was really around how she led us through this COVID pandemic and governing on Zoom. We had a million details to figure out in terms of how do we vote online? How do we get a bill out of committee to the virtual floor? And she pulled members from all parties together and worked so hard to find a plan that worked for everyone and accommodated everyone's needs so we could be successful. And seeing her do that during those 9 months, you know, I mean, we had the longest legislative session in history, and we also had this huge influx of COVID recovery money coming to us from Washington. And to see her juggle all that with so much grace and clarity and direction was really helpful for me as I think about how to lead us now as we enter this new stage of COVID recovery.
Under the House rules, the Speaker, I believe, only gets to participate in votes if there's a tie. Now, that seems to kind of limit your ability to influence things. So what choices can you make as a Speaker to shape the events in the legislature?
Right. Well, the Speaker does have other opportunities to vote. For example, the Speaker does vote when we have a vote on an override. Mm. But, you know, as we work together across party lines to prepare us for this session, you know, I want to make sure that we're putting policy goals on the table that reflect the needs of all Vermonters from every corner of the state. And so what's important for me as I lead us is to make sure that I'm hearing from everyone and I can use my influence on what bills take priority to help reflect what we're hearing from people all across the state. You know, one of the things I'm going to be launching very soon is a virtual listening tour across the state to hear from Vermonters about what's working for them and what's not working for them during this COVID pandemic so that we can have a really strong plan that puts the health and well-being of families first. Yeah.
Why was this position of Speaker of the House one that you wanted?
As I learned the results of Speaker Johnson's race, you know, obviously we were all completely disappointed in those results. And the next morning I got a call from a member that said, please put your name out there for Speaker. And as I digested the moment that we were in and was reflecting on what we've been through, I just felt so moved and compelled by what I learned and how we brought people together to be successful in governing on Zoom to do that. I have a lot of experience with this office in different ways that people might not know about. When Speaker Gay Symington was Speaker, I was her aide at the time.
Oh my.
So I got to see how the office worked from a staff perspective. And then under House Speaker Shep Smith, I was part of the leadership team. And then under, you know, Speaker Johnson, I served with under her as majority leader for 4 years. And I just think it takes someone with strong experience in leading and governing during a pandemic to get us through this.
And Meg from Charlotte is calling. Meg, go right ahead.
Good morning. Hey, Jill, it's Meg Smith from the Vermont Women's Fund.
Hi, Meg. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. And congratulations. And we're very excited about this upcoming session and at this critical time. And one of the things, as you know, the Vermont Women's Fund is a philanthropic resource, and we try and fund economic development for women and girls in across Vermont. And we see that there's some really important things the pandemic has highlighted at how women have been disproportionately affected. Certainly lack of childcare, schools closed, or the hybrid schedule have impacted families across Vermont. How do you see things shaping up in the session that's going to address specifically that? And in the future, women are an economic driver for Vermont and an untapped resource. And I'm hoping that we will change that situation.
Meg, thanks for that question. Representative Kowinski, go right ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Meg, for calling in. I completely agree with you. And I actually spoke about this very issue last night in my response to the governor's State of the State.
You know, this pandemic has hit Vermonters so hard, but it especially has impacted women who have left the workforce because they didn't have access to childcare for their kids. And this is a problem for women, Vermont families, and Vermont's businesses, because if we don't have the workforce to fill these job roles, we can't have successful businesses either. And so as I work to build our policy priorities for this upcoming session, I think that we need to focus on expanding broadband access. You know, people are working from home, their kids are working and learning in these hybrid models, and there's so many challenges with being able to juggle that. We should be able to do better when it comes to broadband, and I know that this is not a simple one to fix, but it's a priority for me for us to do better this session with that. And when it comes to childcare, I have seen firsthand through many of my friends who have struggled, and I've been that backup babysitter to come by and help watch their children while they have to go to work for a meeting. So I just think that this is critical to the health and well-being of our families in this recovery to prioritize access to high-quality, affordable childcare. And lastly, you know, if workers can't find a safe and affordable housing, they're not going to stay in their community, and that's also a problem. So as we look at how we slowly shape our priorities for the session, I've just been hearing so much, and we'll work towards expanding broadband, creating and supporting high-quality, affordable childcare, and affordable housing for Vermonters.
House Speaker, I know this shouldn't be a big deal in 2021, but Speaker of the House, Senate Pro Tem, Lieutenant Governor, House Minority Leader, I can go on, all these positions held by women right now. So how do you feel being part of that wave, that wonderful movement, and the message that it sends to young women?
Absolutely. You know, I'm proud to be part of this historic moment with having all three leaders be women. And I have to say, it's disappointing that it took this long, but I think it's terrific. And it's a wonderful sight for women and young girls in our state to see that women can hold these leadership positions and that we are breaking glass ceilings. You know, Rick Moore, in the State House, one of my favorite things to do is when we have the Girl Scouts visit or Girl State visit, it's to make sure that every single young woman gets a chance to stand behind the podium and look out across the chamber and just have that moment and say, this could be you someday. If you want to be Speaker of the House, you can. And it's just such a great experience to see the look on their faces as they take the moment in.
Let's talk about the COVID-19 and stimulus bill, the most recent one that will probably bring around $500 million to Vermont. How much of that bill have you been able to look over and know what we'll be receiving and how it will be used?
Yeah, we are just starting and getting more information about how this money is coming and what policy areas it's tied to. I was relieved to hear President-elect Biden say that this bill was a down payment, because this doesn't hardly fill the gaps and holes in services that we're seeing, and it's just not enough. And so we're going to have to be really thoughtful and strategic about the way we use this first round of COVID recovery money, and really look forward to working with our federal delegation on the next package.
How do you work with the administration in determining how to distribute this first round, or I guess it's the second round, but this most recent stimulus money?
It's a lot like our budget process. You know, we will be seeing these funds come in, and we will be putting them together in a bill, getting lots of testimony, hearing from people from all walks of life in Vermont about what's been working and what hasn't been working when it comes to recovery funds, making sure that we're using data to make good decisions, and making sure that the administration is in the room with us as we're hearing the testimony and making decisions.
You mentioned the budget. The money from the stimulus package cannot be used to fill the budget hole. We're looking at a rather substantial one. So what are your thoughts on how we go about that?
Had an interruption here.
That happens in this age. And you are the Speaker of the House. That is your priority. So I'm totally okay.
Question again. I'm sorry.
Sure. You mentioned the budget. And the money from the stimulus package can't be used to fill a budget hole. So we're looking at probably a substantial one. How do we go about doing that?
Yes. Well, this money has different restrictions in many different ways. So that's something that we'll be working closely on to make sure that we understand that. We're in the middle of a pandemic and we have limited resources. I think it's really important to us, for me, that as we make these decisions about prioritizing what resources are going where, that we see how this influx of COVID funds actually worked out in communities and with services. And if something was working really well and we made some tweaks and we put some extra funding there and it worked, then let's look at that and let's see that. So I think it's going to be looking at how the money was spent, what the outcomes were, and if need be, we are in a pandemic. And is this the time to use some of our reserve funds? So there's many different places to look to as we pull this budget together.
Unfortunately, we only have about a minute left. But aside from the pandemic, are there legislative priorities you have going into this new biennium?
Well, at this point, Rick, it seems like everything has been tied to this pandemic. You know, I'll say that there are some ongoing challenges that we knew about before that we need to continue to work on. For example, our Vermont State College system. We want to ensure that we have a strong higher education system in place in Vermont. It's critical for our students and for economic development. And, obviously we have a pension challenge that and liability that we're going to need to look at and address this coming biennium.
No, excellent point. Joe Krawinski is a Democratic representative from Burlington and the new Speaker of the House. I want to thank you for your time. Good luck with this new biennium and congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can feel free to suggest topics or guests. And I will tell you that I've got a wide open show on Monday right now looking for some guests. So if you've got ideas, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, please let me know. It'll be very helpful. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. It's Friday, so the governor's COVID-19 response news conference is going to follow the CBS News. You get a little bit of local news from Brady Farkas before the governor. Actually, the governor won't be stepping to the podium, but it is the COVID-19 response news conference. And I'm Rick Singeri. I will meet you back here on Monday. I'll have some kind of a show, I promise.